Is it because you're an accountant, or what's going on there?
Hey, I take offense to that, Joe.
You're stepping into the ring with two guys who pull no punches. This is Entrepreneur Showdown.
Yeah. Monday morning Entrepreneur Showdown time. I am Dan Franks, Joe Cassandra, my partner, my brother from another mother, coming on in just a bit. We're excited today because our local boy is coming on, a PT, Philip Taylor, or as Joe calls him, P-Tizzle, from PTMoney.com. He's joining us in the main event. But just because he's our friend, just because we know him, just because he's our neighbor, doesn't mean we're going to pull any punches, because we are the home to the Pull No Punches Entrepreneur Interviews, and that's exactly what we got coming up in today's main event. Also, don't forget, for the show notes of today's episode and to find out a whole lot more about me, about Joe, and about the Entrepreneur Showdown, you can head on over to where else? EntrepreneurShowdown.com. But with that, let's get on with the showdown.
Round one.
Round one today, we're looking at something maybe we've touched on a couple times, but I don't feel like we've gone that deep into it. And it's ways to discover your business passion. And this is coming from Stephanie Sammons at stephaniesammons.com, fellow Texan. Woo-hoo. And she gives three ways to find business passion that you'll stick with. And when it comes to finding your passion, we've had this discussion with people before. There's always like the woo-woo side of it, and then there's the technical, strategic side of it. And she gives some technical, straightforward tips to finding your passion. And she gives three of them, so I'll just run over them really quick. One of them is lifestyle design, second is work design, and three is people design. And one I hear a lot, if you read a lot of blogs and stuff, is you'll hear lifestyle design. You'll have the questions, okay, what do you want to do with your life? What does your ideal day look like? What do you want your life to look like in 5 years? And I have trouble grasping that type of stuff, because when you say, hey, Joe, what does your ideal day look like? Maybe I'm just lazy, but I don't think it would involve work. I think it would involve traveling and doing stuff like that. Is that the same?
Yes, you are lazy. So yes,
so
you
maybe
are
I am lazy.
No, but and this is fascinating to me, because later on today in round two in the main event, we're getting to Philip Taylor, and I think his thoughts are going to be more like, hey, why don't you start something that has a better chance of working, and then kind of systematize that business and pull yourself out of it, and then you get to that lifestyle design type piece. So it's a more long-term aspect, whereas if your number one thing that you're looking at when you're trying to design this business for yourself is the lifestyle design, then it's almost like you can't see the forest from the trees. You know, because if your main goal is trying to design this lifestyle and then build a business around that, well then I feel like personally your chances are a lot less likely to succeed than if you were to just build a business that works, and then once that business starts going, once it's successful, once it's doing things that you want it to do, then figure out how you can either remove yourself from it or focus on the aspects that fit your lifestyle design. So I think it's kind of it's a dangerous road to cross when you start getting into lifestyle design as the very first thing to look at when picking a business or deciding what direction to go.
So you disagree with what she says about thinking about your specific goals in 5 years and who do you want to spend your time with every day, that type of stuff? You're saying that's not true.
I think it should be factored in, but when in this article, pretty much all three points have to do with that same type thing of really trying to say, hey, what do I want to do? And I know she says, well, what do you want your life to look like in 5 years? But a lot of times people can't see that far in advance. It's all about, you know, what's going on with me now. And when these people hear these buzzwords like lifestyle design, they're thinking about, what does my life need to be like now? I mean, neither you nor I know what our life is going to look like 5 years from now. So trying to plan for that and design our, you know, make our decisions now for that. I think, like I said, I think that's a little dangerous than trying to make something that might be somewhat of a more promising thing currently, and then trying to build that into what you need it to be. I just feel like looking at lifestyle design as a number one, like she does, that's dangerous.
It can be a little rough, but okay, let's look at another one. She talks about people design, and it's designing a business and your passion around people that you enjoy working with, whether it's employees or the clients that you work with. It's important that you get along with the people that you work with. And for me, that's a big thing, because I love dealing with people. I love talking with people. And even if it's something you enjoy doing, if it's with people that you don't necessarily like, you automatically get a bad taste in your mouth with doing it. Just like I loved doing like theater and whatnot in college. I like to write stories and perform those and whatnot. But whenever I did it with people that I really didn't like, I suddenly just had a total disinterest with what I was doing, just because of the people. If the people are giving off negative attitude, or they're just jerks by that's just how they are, you automatically lose the taste in your mouth for what you're doing. I don't know if you've ever had that when you did wrestling. I'm sure you ran into some a-holes sometimes.
Yeah, and I hate to be negative Nancy here, but I'm gonna have to disagree with this one too, because if you think about last week's episode, we talked about doing these personality tests and trying to assemble a team where people's strengths will complement their teammates' weaknesses and things like this. But if you totally try to design your business around people that you like, you're going to get a bunch of extroverts or a bunch of introverts kind of working together. You're not going to necessarily be able to assemble this dream team of people that work together, great. So maybe your personalities fit, but maybe that's because all your weaknesses are the same and all your strengths are the same. I know the people that I like to hang out with aren't the best people to work with, because you're gonna, if you're a bunch of social people, you're gonna be socializing a lot more than working. And when you maybe get a little bit of work done, you might enjoy it more. But if you're going towards productivity and trying to create this business and really trying to bootstrap things for yourself, I really think you need to kind of take a step back and say, like, okay, I can separate the people that I work with from the people I want to hang out with. And sure, maybe there's a little bit of crossover, but at the end of the day, what's your goal? Is your goal just to have fun? And if you you're not that successful, are you going to be happy with that? Or are you really trying to build something that's sustainable? And in which case, you do need to find people that complement each other's weaknesses and really, fill those gaps when you're assembling a team.
So the people, see, I think I have to work with people to enjoy what I'm doing, but you're saying you'd want to be with people that you enjoy being around as a way to relax, not as much to work. Is that right?
Well, I mean, look, you and I work together, and when we get talking to each other, time disappears, and next thing I know, we just, blabbered on about God knows what for 30 minutes. So, I mean, if it was a team full of people like us that had these common interests that could talk to each other, it helps when you're working next to somebody who maybe you're not going to have a 30-minute conversation with that's off topic, but maybe you're going to get right to the point, and they're going to help you, or you're going to help them, and then they're going to take off and not bother you again until there's something else that needs to be done, versus you or I. If you or I are working together on something, we'll end up talking for an hour about something unrelated. So I feel like it's more enjoyable that way, but maybe not as productive.
So I think Dan's sending a subtle hint to not bother him while he was working. So I will.
Don't bother me while I'm vacuuming my room.
I will make a note of that and make sure not to do that. she mentions something that you hear all the time, and it is, don't build a business around something where you're doing it just because you see a financial reward. I guess a large financial reward, because you always expect to have a financial reward, because I guess you get burned out after a while. For since this is topical, and you're doing the podcast movement, you're seeing all this cash flooding into Kickstarter, do your priorities change or your passion change when you start seeing this influx of cash that maybe you weren't expecting at first, because you set the bar for the podcast movement at 11,000 and now it's over 25,000? Do your priorities or vision start changing because you see all this cash coming in?
I think it's a tightrope that you have to walk, because you put this vision out to the people, especially in our instance with a Kickstarter type campaign and crowdfunding. You put your vision and your story out to people, and then they're basing their contributions and their purchases and their pledges and all of this based on that story. And so you look and you say, hey, we got twice as much money as we thought we would. So what path do we want to go? Do we want to change that story for this increased money than we had planned on? Or do we want to stick to what people bought into? So people bought into a certain thing. Because it would be very easy to say, hey, well, we were going to go this far, but now that we got extra money, we can go a little further. Well, that little further, it's going to cost more money. It's going to cost more time and resources. And you're not sure if that's what they actually want, because that's not what they bought into in the first place. So I feel like it's a tightrope, and we have not gotten to the point where the cash is, become available to make those decisions. But certainly strategically, there's things we're considering now that we never considered before. Anything from, hey, you know, maybe this original venue, based on these early ticket sales, how fast they've gone, maybe this original venue isn't the right place. Maybe we need something a little different. Or, hey, we were thinking about having X many speakers, and now maybe we're able to go a little further than that, or certain aspects, you know, certain branding, or for instance, the mobile app. That's something we're researching now. So we are maybe thinking of something very basic like the Skedge app. I forget what the website is, but a lot of people use it. NMX used it, but there's a lot of really cool apps that use a lot of social media and a lot of this gamification, which is something we should probably get into at some point because it's becoming very popular. But, you know, what do we do? Do we stick to something cheap like the original plan was? But, or do we use this extra money to go that extra step? So I feel like, that's when you get this kind of thing that you don't expect, it's tough.
But your passion hasn't changed from, okay, you started this movement to bring people together and to make a little money. It's your first year, and you had told me you don't expect to make a ton of money the first year. But now you see the success of doubling the goal that you had already set. Does your passion suddenly change to, okay, now how about we focus on making a lot more money now?
No, I think that's a very short-sighted view. When you launch something and it's way more successful than you thought, you have the two options. You can either reinvest and really try to leverage that to your advantage, or you can take the quick exit and take the cash now and then, kind of maybe cut off your legs for anything future. So I really think if you're truly passionate about it on the front end, your passion is not going to change. You get into it for a certain reason. And if you kind of change directions like you've hinted towards, and like Stephanie talks about in this article, then maybe that wasn't your true passion to begin with.
That's an interesting take on it. It's just interesting to see how people react when they suddenly have more money than they thought they would have, and where their priorities go and where their passion really lies. Is it with making a lot of money, or is it with doing something that you love? Because especially in like very high stress, high work hour type positions like lawyers and usually CEOs and all that, are they in it because they love doing it and running the company and making it the best it can? Or is it because of the stock options, golden parachute, and all that stuff?
Well, and I've talked about something similar to that before, my history in real estate. And I had a personal relationship with some people that started out, and every time they closed a big deal, they'd go have a nice dinner. And then it turned into every time they had to keep growing it because they found out that they were working really towards the reward. It wasn't the work that they were enjoying, but it was going towards that reward at the end. So then they started, went from a steak dinner to some kind of, overnight, staying at the hotel dinner. And then it built up into, hey, we're going to take a long weekend to the beach for every time we close something. And then it turned into, hey, we're going to go to the Caribbean every time we close a big deal. And it grows and grows and grows. And then their motivation goes from, really enjoying the work they did to just trying to keep reaching for that reward at the end. And then eventually when things go crashing down, you can't go back to that original passion. You've already, kind of proven to yourself that that wasn't your original passion. Your passion was whatever you were getting at the end of it. You weren't really liking the work to begin with, which I think maybe goes to what Stephanie is talking about here. Because these people that I had this relationship with, they got so far, so deep into it that when it crashed, they could have very easily started over and gone back to doing what got them to that, the successful spot in the first place. But they'd already proven to themselves that that's not why they were truly into it. So that they could never fully get back into it again. And they changed paths completely despite being really good at what they were doing. So I think maybe to that, I disagreed to everything Stephanie said on this front end. But at the end of the day, if those people really had evaluated what their true motivation for doing what they, what they were doing, they probably would have never started that path in the first place.
Definitely. Well, definitely go check out Stephanie's article. We'll put in the show notes as always. But especially if you're in that position where you're not sure and you're using it as an excuse to find what you're really passionate about, definitely go check it out. But let's get on to the round two and main event with PT Money.
Round two.
In round two today, we're looking at an article by Philip Taylor, also known as PT Money. And we're actually digging into the archives of his site, ptmoney.com, to find a piece that we want to discuss with him. And the piece we're going to talk with him about is starting a business with no money. And you hear all the time, I read some like tech blogs, and you see all the time like all these companies getting funded for millions of dollars. And that can kind of be discouraging because you feel like if you want to build anything spectacular, you have to have this massive venture capitalist come in and invest millions of dollars in you. But in his post, he says, hey, just start off with something small. Start off with, he gives some ideas, moving company, mowing lawns and whatnot. And you'll just learn pretty much business. You may not learn full scale business that like the big companies are running, that maybe you see the venture capitalists investing millions of dollars, but you can get to learn how cash flow works, balance sheet, profit and loss and whatnot. Is that kind of like what you were thinking when you read it?
Yeah, you know, this is a different outlook than what we normally talk about, because we talk about a lot of things, finding whatever you're passionate about or whatever it is that you think you can do to build a successful business for yourself that might take off or do something for you on the long term. And a lot of times that's what we talk about. But what he's talking about, like you said, you mentioned the lawn mowing or the moving company. These are things that most people don't set out to do for their entire lives. You know, you're not going to start a dog walking business and try to do that, you know, as a full-time career. A lot of people use that to maybe, like you said, get that business experience or build up some capital and learn how to run your own business and run your own everything, and then kind of parlay that into something bigger. So I think it's interesting that he's kind of taken the start small approach. And I think obviously that's because this article is about starting with no money at all. So he's kind of giving different techniques to what you can do when you start with no money. But I think it'll be interesting to talk to PT about what you need to do to keep the greater goal in mind, because it would be really easy to get super sucked into walking dogs, you know, 40 or 50 hours a week, and then not be able to, you know, if you stop doing it and the money stops coming in, there's not really a great way to, you know, put that on autopilot. I don't know. So to answer your question, I think it's interesting in that I did take it the same way as you, but I think there's got to be some greater goal in mind, regardless of how you start.
Well, nowadays, especially since people's money is tight. Since money is tight.
I don't know. My money are pretty tight right now, too.
My monies are tight. I think people also get sucked into this online world because it's starting to get, online stuff is gaining traction, blogging, podcasts, all that jibber jab. And people are starting to see that as, oh, well, maybe that's where the money is, because that's all these people are making money off of that. But I think that can also be, I feel like that can also be a temptation, because, hey, there is a low barrier of entry.
It's too easy.
Oh, it's super easy nowadays. You just throw up a WordPress page and bazing, you're off and going.
Well, yeah, that's the one thing I picked out of his, was that he is, in the beginning of it at least, recommending maybe do something physical. Like, if you physically go out and have to get clients for whatever this physical thing you're doing is, then you're going to learn the lessons better and kind of get your foot in the door better than trying to start a bunch of little mini niche sites and being able to just give up. You don't have real clients when you do a lot of this online business. So there's no accountability. There's no one kind of that you've made an agreement with that's expecting you to perform. A lot of it's on your own. So I think that's where a lot of people kind of get sucked in and then just don't do anything with it.
Yeah. That's an interesting point that you say, hey, he's saying go do something physical. Basically, you have to hustle a little bit. And that's what, with his physical type businesses that he's talking about, you actually have to go and hustle, sell, basically learn some selling to try and get referrals from your initial clients. Because he has an equation at the bottom that is, get your first customer. Next step, do a great job. Next step, ask them to refer you. That ask them to refer you requires a little salesmanship, which requires a little bit of hustling on your part. While in the online space, like you said, you may not have recurring clients. You may just think you can throw up these landing pages and just make money that way, where you're not going to learn maybe as much the business chops as if you actually have to go and sell your skills, sell yourself, sell the dream of, hey, your lawn could be the best in town or whatnot. Like, you have to learn how to do that if you're actually doing face-to-face type sales. And maybe that's where he's going with it. He did write this article in 2011, so maybe it was I don't know when the online spree started.
It was going on then. I mean, it had started then with the blogs and all that. But I do think this is a lot like, you know, kind of bootstrapping is what he's advocating here. And you mentioned a lot of people talk about getting venture capital and things like that. Those are people who are probably, if they're getting this capital investment, they've developed really good products, but it's the business savvy that they're missing. And then when they get infused with this money, they still don't have that business savvy. In fact, I was talking with a client of mine today who they're really good at what they do, at what their art is, but they don't have the business savvy, and they got into some business relationships that just completely screwed them over because they didn't have the business savvy. They knew 100% everything about the business, the art that they were working on, but everything that encompasses it to make a business successful, they didn't have. So for Philip to advocate, you know, starting small, but starting on your own and really learning, you know, in the trenches, that's, I think, gaining invaluable experience. And to me, that's one of the biggest takeaways from this article, not necessarily the starting with $0 or anything like that, but just starting on your own and learning the hard way on some of these things.
Yeah. So let's just hold off on speculating anymore. Let's just get to PT in the main event and talk about some of these tactics that he's talking about, where maybe you're going to have to hustle a little bit, and hear about maybe if he has a story or two about where he had to do that. So let's get to PT Money in the main event.
It's time for the main event.
On the main event today, we have Philip Taylor, a.k.a. PT Money, a.k.a. I'm going to call him P Tizzle, because that's just how sweet he is. He is a self-proclaimed geek of personal finance, and he's the first CPA we've had on our show, because Dan's a CPA, but we've never had another one. So Phil is also a CPA. He started in 07, like I mentioned, and then also is the founder of FinCon, the number one financial conference for bloggers. Philip Taylor, PT, P Tizzle, how you doing today?
What up, what up? Awesome intro, Joe. Thanks. Glad to be here, man.
Has anyone called you P Tizzle? Is that a new one or is that old news?
That's totally new, but I was at NMX a couple years ago, and I got someone came up to me, and they were like, dude, I know who you are. You're on the internet. Your name is, what did he call me? Not PT Money. Call me PT Dollars.
PT, I like that. PT Dollars.
So,
I love it.
Guy was with me, made fun of me, and he calls me PT Dollars to this day.
PT Dollars. For the listeners, PT, he lives like 20 minutes away from us, but we're doing this all over Skype, so none of us are in the same room. And
well, we were, Joe and PT, we were talking about this right before we came on, that we're within about a 5 to 7 mile radius of each other, you know, the three of us, yet we're all in our individual homes doing this. It's pretty, it's a sad state of affairs. Yeah.
Technology has come too far. We could have been hanging out, drinking a beer together.
Well, you said, you talked about before recording, you have cookies too. I want some of those cookies. before we dive into the topic at hand, is there a recent podcast you've been on that tells your backstory really well?
Yeah, I just did Star of the Doubts with Jared Easley. And I went into a lot of kind of what I went through with my early entrepreneur career and kind of overcoming some of those initial hurdles. So that'd be a good one to look at.
Our buddy Jared, we love sending traffic to his way. Okay, so getting on to this topic, we talk about start a business with no money. And we actually dug into the archives for this one, which we don't usually do for guests. But for you, we had to pull out something special. And you talk a lot about, for starting up a business with no money, you talk about a lot of physical businesses like lawn mowing and moving company and whatnot. Is that a lot of people nowadays, they want to try and do the easy way of starting something online because the barrier of entry just keeps going down in that way. Do you recommend people starting to look that way, or do you think there is a benefit of doing these physical type of businesses?
Well, I mean, certainly play to your strengths, right? But I guess the reason I recommend the more physical one is because that's kind of always been the low hanging fruit for me, right? I mean, everyone's got a truck, everyone's got a lawnmower, so those things sort of just stand out for me. But I think whatever, and like you said, the barriers have come down, so certainly, you know, whatever you feel like is more attainable for you initially. I think the maybe the larger point here is that I pointed to things that if you were to translate lawn mowing and moving company or moving truck to the online world, that would be something like freelancing or something where, you know, you created a blog for someone else and got paid. And so there's kind of an instant payment associated with it, right? So I think that'll be the way to translate it to the online world.
I find it interesting that you said kind of the physical job is maybe the low-hanging fruit in your eyes, where I think a lot of people, Joe and I included, it's a lot easier to get into doing something online. I mean, there's so many, you know, scammy niche sites that you can make out there right now, you know, these little micro niche sites that just trying to game the system, that to me, that seems like the lowest possible barrier of entry. But it's not necessarily something quality. And I think Joe and I talked about in round two, that maybe doing something physical would force you to actually be more involved and to dedicate a little more of your time resources towards doing something and maybe hold more accountable to getting this started, because it's so easy to ditch something online. You a lot of times don't have any real clients versus in person. You have somebody that you've met face to face and things like that. Do you see any value in that type of that aspect of it?
Absolutely. And also there's just the element of, you know, I think when I wrote this, you know, for me, working online made a lot of sense, you know, but I think just we're in this internet world and we live here. And so I think a lot of people who maybe I thought were interacting with my content might not be quite to that stage yet. And so I just was maybe trying to angle it toward people who had more general type of work and assets to, you know, to implement. So that maybe that's what I was thinking.
Well, a lot of people, they read these big sites, like I read Business Insider all the time, and they always highlight, okay, this startup just got funded for $500 million or whatever, and here you're talking about starting up a lawn mowing company. How are you supposed to motivate someone to say, okay, I'm going to start a lawn mowing company and work for hours on end while you read all these stories about people getting funded for millions of dollars? Why aren't you trying to push people to go that way, to the startup techie world, instead of these manual labor type things?
Right, that's a good question. Well, for one, you know, bootstrapping is what I know. It's what I've lived and what I experience, and so it's what's worked for me. But also, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with a little manual labor, a little hard work, because that can, I mean, don't put yourself in a box with the type of job you're doing. So say you start out as a mowing grass for someone, and then maybe you hire a couple of guys and it becomes a lawn mowing service. And then maybe you have four or five crews and you got a really big thing running here. But then maybe you become like a lawn mowing business consultant, or maybe you figure out how to get into the lawn mowing, lawnmower industry or something. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, any of these things can lead to something that's scalable for you that could become the next big wow thing. So don't just because you're starting with something like this, similar, just like I said, with freelancing online, it's the low hanging fruit. Like, go after that first thing and then figure out how to scale it after that point. Like, the scaling part is the fun part anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, bootstrapping's fun. You know, it's what I've done. And I think a lot of people who are entrepreneur types kind of want that, kind of need that, you know.
For someone who, okay, does go with, okay, fine, I'll start something manual-ish labor, does it have to be something that they really love to do? Like, no one loves cutting lawn. Maybe some people do love cutting their lawn. But if I'm not passionate, gung-ho about it, why would I ever want to pursue that? Why wouldn't I want to find something that I really love to do instead of maybe that low-hanging fruit is, hey, go mow your neighbor's lawn and start making money that way?
Right. Well, for me, the fun part is figuring out how to ramp up the business. I mean, you could talk to some people who are not entrepreneurially minded, and you know, they would never think to sort of try to scale a business like that. But for me, when I started online, you know, I wasn't making any money, but then I figured out how to eventually scale that. So I think it just comes down to if you're the type of person who wants a business. I mean, the name of this post is Start a Business, not Start a Job for Yourself. Or start something that's, you know, never going to advance or lead to something else. It's starting a business of something that you eventually be able to leverage or scale or get to a, you know, a higher plane with. So, I mean, that's kind of the mindset. Hopefully the reader tackling this is looking at and kind of sees the light at the end of the tunnel with that.
Well, something Joe and I have talked about quite a bit because it's a personal failure of mine is I started something on my own a few years ago and it became real successful with me doing it on my own. But then I tried to scale it. And there was some kind of disconnect between me doing it on my own and when I had it scaled up to where I thought it needed to be, to where it totally crashed and burned and I couldn't recover it anymore. So there's some tipping point somewhere where you cross over the point where you actually do need to scale versus you should probably keep doing it on your own. Do you have any kind of metric or what's your determining factor towards, yes, I can keep doing this on my own until this point and then maybe I need to scale it and, you know, whether it's bring on more people or put some additional systems in place? Kind of what do you use to decide that?
Well, you know, I would say certainly the thing that the unique value that you add to the business, I mean, that's the kind of thing you want to be doing, right? So you still want to focus on providing that or figuring out a way that you can, you know, help, you know, teach someone to be able to do that for you. But certainly start outsourcing or start leveraging up on the areas that aren't as important or the areas that are maybe more challenging for you or more less a part of the unique part of your business. So, for instance, if you start this lawn mowing business and the best thing you do is go meet door to door and sell, you know, and make connections and get more lawns, then that's probably what you should be doing more of. You should actually look for the guys to actually mow the grass for you. But if you're like the best, you know, lawn guy out there and you're, you know, your landscaping or what you're doing with the grass care and all that is the best, then maybe, you know, focus some energy on that and look for someone else to sell for you. So I guess maybe just look for the things that you're good at and they're kind of giving you energy for the business. Focus on those. But also create systems, like you said. I mean, that's really the ultimate challenge of any business any self-employed person is learning to kind of pull yourself out of it, you know, and how to do that. And I mean, that's why I forget the guy's name, but I mean, the book, The E-Myth, is such a
Michael Gerber.
Yeah, Gerber. I mean, that's such an effective message because that's sort of where we all get at some point. And I'm certainly still there in many ways with my businesses. And so I think that's always going to be a challenge for people.
Yeah. And I think it's important to always start with kind of that end game in mind. You know, that's something that a lot of people don't do. They just kind of get going, but eventually you need to put some kind of, you know, end game or end goal to it. So you have some direction to go. Something Joe and I talked about in round two was a personal experience that I had, not myself, but with some people I've been working with, and they're experts in their field. They know exactly what it is. But they'd always been employees and they were great employees and they decided to go out on their own and kind of make a lateral move. So as opposed to starting at the bottom and bootstrapping and really learning the business aspect of their art, they just kind of made a lateral move and tried to create a business around, you know, the level they were at. I don't know if that makes sense. But do you have any experience with that or do you have any advice for people that maybe don't want to hit the reset button? They're great employees at what they do, but they really want to do it on their own without starting over fresh.
I'm not really sure I understand your question, Dan. Sorry.
No. Okay. So they've been employees and what they do at their job is great, but they want to have their own business, but they don't necessarily have the business savvy to do it, but they want to do it on their own. So they can't afford to bring a bunch of people in, you know, business consultants or anything like that. So they're trying to build this business around their art.
I see.
How would you do that? Would you say the only way to do it is to kind of start at the bottom and learn the business around it, or is there some other techniques they can use?
Yeah. Well, thing I've been doing in my business is certainly looking for partners, whether that be a partner that's actually involved heavily in the business or just someone who's a freelancer who does work for my business. So, if it's something that really is a black box for me, like I really don't understand that aspect of the business, then I'm going to ask for help initially. And there's no sense in me. I mean, I guess it's it's wise to know a little bit about how that works. But for the most part, if someone can do it better, someone can do it quicker, why not use that person if you have no, you know, certainly if you have no interest in it. For instance, I'll give you an example. When I first started FinCon, I had no idea how to go out and ask hotels if I could come have the conference there. And so luckily, I stumbled upon a service that does that for you. And initially, I mean, immediately I outsourced that, and I've really never learned. Now we've had our fourth conference, we're coming up on our fourth conference, and really never learned how to go out and find hotels. But this woman does it perfectly, and we always have a good location. And I respect that part of our business, but it's not something I'm involved in. So I would kind of take that approach maybe.
Well, you just mentioned something that you outsource with FinCon. So what was something that you knew in your heart, I am really good at this part of organizing this conference, because since you started it, that you took head on, just to give like an example of something that maybe you were really good at and you were sure that only you could get this job done?
Yep, certainly the content. So the content of what got on stage at FinCon is something that I've always owned and I'll always try to own. And try to be a part of. So who gets on stage and what they say and talk about is something that I think ultimately, you know, makes or breaks what your conference is. And so that's something that I've always wanted to be a part of, and I'll continue to be. That's pretty taxing too, because I want a lot of people to be involved in the community and in the conference that are from the community. It's a peer driven conference. So a lot of voices from the community that come out and want to speak, and a lot of good messages they want to bring. And it's a challenge to tell a lot of people no, unfortunately, but I have to do that. But it's for the sake of putting something together that's great. And so that's something I'm always going to stick to.
I want to put a little spin on Joe's question. So he asked, what were you really good at and you add value with that you wanted to keep for yourself? But eventually you grow to the point where there's stuff that you're good at that you do have to let the reins go of. Have you had anything like that, that you, even though you were good at it and you might be the best at it, you just could not continue to do it and you had to let it go? What was your process for finding somebody that you were, you know, willing to let go and not micromanage doing that job?
That's a good question. I was never really good at sponsorships. So that's a bad one.
Well, or maybe you're not, but you see at some point something coming down the line, and what's your technique going to be to actually, you know, let those reins go? Because it's your projects and what you're doing is growing; they're not shrinking. So your time's getting pulled at, you know, more directions. So there's got to be something that, you know, eventually you see coming down the pipeline that you're going to have to replace yourself to do.
Right. Well, I'll just give you the. I mean, from a high level, I don't know that I have any good advice in that area. I mean, it's a challenge for me, I'll be honest with you, Dan. Something that I have done in the past is, and this is probably just a quick tip, is I've used my VA, who does a lot of work for FinCon, to actually, because to me, actually searching for the person to do the work that you're looking to get done is a challenge as well, right? So I've actually used my VA, my current one, to actually help me through that process. So instead of starting from square one and looking for someone to help out with the process, I actually give my VA that specific task. Go find someone to do this part of the business, train them on how to do it, and get them going. So I don't know that answers your question, but that's kind of something I've been using lately to get some of those little things done.
Well, just since it's kind of topical right now, when you started FinCon, did you raise money, or were you dishing out money on your own? Just because since Dan's working on the Kickstarter right now for the Podcast Movement Conference and they're raising all the money, how did you go about getting that initial seed money for your conference?
Well, you know, luckily with an event, you really don't have to pay for things until, for the most part, until a few weeks before the conference or after, on the day of the conference or after. So luckily, all the expenses are kind of in one little time frame there. And I was able to sell tickets and sponsorships before the event happened and get comfortable with those amount and stay within my budget. So that's something I did there.
Well, you say you weren't good. You said before you weren't good at getting sponsorships. So what did you do?
Oh, well, I certainly reached out to, you know, the business contacts that I did already have through PT Money. I'd established relationships, affiliate marketing relationships, and other types of content relationships with big financial brands that I knew could benefit from being at this conference. And so essentially I just reached out to those contacts I had, showed them the opportunity, made it really easy. I think I even put the sponsorships on Eventbrite so they could actually purchase them from that webpage themselves and didn't have to invoice them or do anything like that. And so that's what I did. Just kind of did those cold calls like that with the contacts that I already had. That worked.
Is there something that, looking back now, you would have done differently in raising that money?
I would have thought bigger with the conference. Yeah, I was. I planned a. I should have, certainly held out a lot more opportunities and a lot higher priced opportunities initially. I just had no idea, who all was going to sign up or what would be a part of it. But I think one thing I did do, and I think I've shared with you guys, that I sort of tiered my sponsorships, where I had one level of sponsorship, and then if once those sold out, once we got to a number of ticket sales, then I would release a second round of sponsorships. And that was something that helped me to grow into a bigger conference, and that was beneficial.
So I think it's interesting because you just said that in the conference, you maybe didn't think big enough. You took a little bit of the safer route, just kind of the sure road. Mm-hmm. And then in this article we're looking at, you also said something similar, because a portion of this article you talk about when it's time to reinvest in your company. So you're starting out with no money, but at some point you start buying the lawnmowers instead of using someone else's lawnmowers, those type things. Mm-hmm. But you said you didn't reinvest soon enough. So you didn't reinvest soon enough, and you didn't kind of think big enough on the conference. Yep. Yet your business is successful and your conference is successful. So, I mean, maybe do you think that kind of being a little more conservative with things is the right path for somebody to go? Or do you think there's some kind of balance there that you haven't quite found yet, or that you're still working on?
Yeah. There's certainly a balance to be had, but I feel like I'm too conservative in general, I think those early conferences that I had, I regret trying to, because I had another business that was successful. I had something else sustaining me. So my blog, just kind of a backstory, my blog, PT Money, talks to a lot of people who are part-time entrepreneurs or want to start something on the side. So they may have a corporate gig that they're working that's providing for their family and more, and they're wanting to start something on the side and think about bringing in some extra money to maybe, provide a little more financial freedom or whatever it is, maybe make that transition one day themselves. So put that in context of this discussion. I think that's important. And so, early on, PT Money was supporting me, and I had no reason not to try to make the biggest, best, awesomest conference ever. Thinking back, I should have just poured every dollar. I think I made 10 or 15 grand on that first conference. I should have spent that 10 or 15 grand to make a better conference and not made any money on the conference, but blown everyone's minds and blown everyone away and made everyone super happy. And maybe taken that 10 or 15 grand invested in advertising to get more people at the next conference. But, I was conservative. I didn't do that. At the time I kind of played it safe, and that's kind of one of the things I wish maybe I would have done.
So you think sitting here four conferences from, from then, or the four, that was the first and this is the fourth, you think it'd be much bigger now had you done that on the front end?
I kind of have that feeling, yeah, that maybe I would have had a little more wow factor, I don't know. It's hard to tell. I mean, there's only so many in the community.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the struggle, and Joe mentioned it, and this isn't about me, but since we're on this topic, eventually you're going to reach close to the capacity of the people in the community, so the last thing you want to do is overbuild, right? And I mean, I think this can apply to any of these jobs we're talking about, or any kind of business you're talking about. I think no well is bottomless. Everything, eventually you're going to get to the bottom. So it's a matter of trying to balance that conservatism with, the aggressiveness, and trying to find a happy ground. And I guess that's kind of an invisible place in the middle of it that no one really knows where it's at.
Yeah, you're right. And there's no way to know initially. So you just kind of have to trust your gut. But I think in the future, and as your finances become more stable, you're able to take a little more risk. And I think people should, especially when someone's young like us and they have a good second stream of income coming in. I definitely think I should have been more aggressive. And I think people should be, who are in our similar situation. be aggressive with these side hustles like this.
Are you not aggressive just because that's just your personality, is to be more conservative, or is it because you're an accountant, or what's going on there?
Hey, I take offense to that, Joe.
Probably so. Yeah, I'm just a conservative guy. My wife is as well. And so there's a balance to be had here in the household. So that's, you know, just trying to balance all those demands and needs.
Hey, PT, I got to jump in here. So we're sitting here at the beginning of March, and this episode's going to go live pretty quick from here. So this is kind of the busy season for accountants. Do you relish these times of the years now when you used to dread them when you were in the accounting industry?
Definitely. It's crazy because my dad is still a CPA and has his own practice, tax practice. And so I sort of live vicariously through him. I feel like his 40 years of tax returns, I feel that every spring, like, the pressure he's going through right now. And ironically, we've had all of our children in the spring over the past few years. And so my poor dad can't ever make it down here to see his grandkids. But yeah, I know what you mean on that kind of the pressure of the busy season. Yeah, I'm done with it.
Did you ever think about starting your own practice like your dad?
I gave that some thought, but client-facing work has never suited me well. So being in front of clients face-to-face is not something I ever excelled at. So I always shied away from that aspect of the business. If I could have done it more passively, had more of a passive approach to a firm, like I see a lot of guys now have tax practices where they, you know, where they barely talk to the clients. And not that I don't like communication, but that kind of business has more of an appeal to me, where it's a little more passive in nature. And that's why I think I was attracted to online business.
But isn't a conference, that's a lot of face-to-face stuff, isn't it?
You're right. It is it is the opposite of passive. And, you know, you're at the heart in the middle of 500 people coming at you from all different angles, wants and needs. And that's a challenge. That certainly, that pushes me more than anything.
Are you a natural introvert?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. I get my energy from hanging out, recouping alone, and kind of, I like being around people, but I just need that time to recharge by myself, you know?
I was going to say that week after the conference, you must just like lock yourself in a room and just like veg.
Yeah. It's weird. I mean, even at the conference, I have to kind of break away and get some me time, but yeah, that's been one of the challenging parts of having an event, for sure.
How do you balance all those, since you said there are like 500 people coming at you, how do you balance all those relationships or keep up with those relationships? Or is it just kind of like one of those, I'm just going to see you once a year at this event, pretty much?
I'm probably bad at being proactive with that. I try to engage with people regularly. I'm in some mastermind groups. I participate in our forum and our Facebook group. So I have some connection points there. But I probably should be more proactive. I'm more in a putting out fire mode, where I get a lot of emails and I have to interact with everyone who sends me emails. So that's probably a poor way to do it. And I've done a better job of engaging Jessica, my VA, into answering some of those questions so that I'm not always putting out fires. But that's something I think you should be doing as an event planner, is being more proactive with those relationships and seeking out connections with new people. And that's one of the biggest challenges.
Well, you have an equation at the bottom of this article. Get one customer, do a great job, and then ask them to refer you. Do you have a strategy or some sort of script for the referral process? Or do you have an experience where maybe that question didn't go as well as you hoped or anything like that?
Well, I certainly do with FinCon. Probably not a script, but it's just sort of inherently built into the nature of an event. I mean, I seek feedback from attendees. I do things like using social proof on all my sales pages in addition to testimonials. So I engage with prior attendees. We do a video interviews at each conference where we kind of get information from, and those are powerful. I mean, we get kind of the why you come to FinCon question asked, and that carries a lot of weight going forward with new attendees. So that's some of the things we have built into the to the event to make sure that next year, you know, people can be can see sort of the, some of those feedback and get that referral and hopefully make a new sale, bring in a new customer.
Well, let's talk about just on the business level, not necessarily the conference, but if you perform some kind of business for somebody, it's very awkward to try to approach them like, hey, by the way, if you like what I did, send me some business. But what's your mindset going into things like that? So let's not talk about attendees where you're kind of the boss over the attendees, so to speak, or you're the head honcho, but someone that you're, you know, just doing a one-on-one work with,
right,
but you really need their referral or you would appreciate the referral. How do you ask for that?
I don't know that I have a script for that.
Cause I mean, that's the cheapest form of advertising, right? And that's, and we're talking about trying to do something with little to no money. Yep. And that's the cheapest way to do it is to get people to spread the word.
I mean, yeah, nothing wrong with saying at the close of the sale, the writing of the check, hey, if you think I did a good job, would you mind giving me a testimonial? Would you mind, you know, to telling your friends and family about what I've done with you here? You know, I guess that's the approach I would take. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I don't have a mastermind answer there.
we'll keep searching. Okay. Then.
So, okay, since you started this site in 07, you've been doing this for 7 years now. What do you do? Because, I mean, I do some writing and then I get really tired after just a little bit, but you've been doing it for 7 years. What do you do to get over those writing blocks and keeping coming up with new content and whatnot?
Yeah. Well, luckily, I'm pretty broad in my topic. I write about anything about money or personal finance under the sun. So, you know, anything that's coming down the pipe for me personally, what I'm investing with, what, you know, credit card I'm using, what insurance I just bought, or, you know, anything like that that comes down the pipe, I share it and I get it out there for people to absorb. Some of it probably comes across as a little too me focused these days, but that's kind of the only, that's kind of the content that is easy for me to put out there. Is kind of a natural extension of me just living my life with money, you know, sharing those things online. And I do try to flip it on its head and say, okay, based on my experience going through this thing, then what are some takeaways or what are some things people can kind of pull from? So that's really the horse I'm riding is what I've been doing. Now, I also have the benefit of being able to freshen and republish some of my older content that's kind of evergreen. So I do a little bit of that as well. But mostly just relying on that that personal experience. I mean, it takes me a long ways. It means I don't post as much anymore. I think I've gone to maybe 2 or 3, maybe at most a week, versus, you know, back in the day is to do, you know, pretty much one a day. So I've slowed down a bit and I just try to focus on things that really resonate with me and that are impacting me personally. That way I can kind of share it and it has a little more oomph to the topic when I'm sharing it versus just something generic, you know.
This is a weird question, but the PT Bunny, the PT is your initials, right? Not part-time, or is it part-time?
Well, back in 2007 when I started as Prime Time Money.
Prime Time, okay.
Prime Time.
Yeah.
Deion Sanders?
Deion Sanders, and that was my nick. Me and Deion go way back. So
sweet. Got to introduce us.
No, back in the 90s when Deion was a rapper, and my initials are PT, Philip Taylor. So so just my buddies in high school just called me Primetime or PT. And so that's when I started the blog. That's kind of one thing that resonated with me was, hey, Primetime Money. And then I started the Part-Time Money podcast because, hey, I was a part-time entrepreneur now. And I've sort of shifted the meaning to that. So no longer Prime-Time Money. I'm just kind of PT Money, which also have the Part-Time Money podcast. And I'm thinking about making another change and making the site Part-Time Money officially, like putting that actually in the title. I don't know. I don't know if you guys have any opinions on that, but
so it's you're trying to go to Part-Time Money. It's not Philip Taylor Money.
No, that's okay. It's just PT Money. So I guess it is Philip Taylor Money now. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a confusing branding.
it is because it's implied because the the motto at the bottom of the logo at the top of the website is do more with your money in half the time. So that implies that the PT stands for part-time.
Right. So I'm halfway there. I think I'm about to fully commit to the part-time.
Well, I was just wondering if it was your initials, because I was wondering if you recommend that type of personal branding on your websites instead of random names that I've, like, we have Entrepreneur Showdown instead of Dan and Joe Showdown or whatnot.
Well, I mean, there's advantages to both. Certainly, I think with it being PT Money and me putting my face all over the thing, I've become known as PT Money, and it's more brandable personally for me. So there's advantages that way, but also if I ever wanted to sell the site to someone else, you know, certainly part-time money would do a lot better with a sale. So that's just a couple things to think about there. Yeah.
Is that a foreshadowing? Are you entertaining offers to sell your site right now?
No. I'm not quite in that point, but
not going JD Roth yet.
You know, there was a time a year or two ago where I was a little more leaning more that direction, but I see PT Money as something that I can maybe take a long ways with me. You know, I feel like I've got a lot more to develop on the site. I'm sort of in a weird mode with it now where I'm focusing a lot of my time and energy on the conference, and I haven't been able to spend as much time and do like cool posts like we talked about here as much anymore. And you know, hopefully one day I can get back to that. So maybe I sell the conference after this year and I get back to PT Money and develop it into something cool. So
I think it's fascinating that, you know, we've talked about Jim Wang before we started coming on, who were a big fan of Bargaineering, what he started back in the day and sold out, you know, made the big money on, and same with Roth. Mm-hmm. But you know, you're not quite with them in terms of that sellout and having that name value as them, yet you're running the super successful podcast or the super successful conference that, you know, they're kind of either attendees or speaking at or something like that. So you've kind of elevated yourself in a certain way to a different level than them. Do you feel like that the doing the conference just completely kind of changed who you were and how you're seen compared to what PT Money was before that?
Absolutely. Yeah, certainly. I hit it at the right time. You're right. I mean, I was kind of you know, a middle of the road player, if you will, in the PF sphere. But the conference certainly elevated me to, you know, if you want to talk about tiers or whatever, I mean, certainly, that kind of thing. I was more recognized and more known, certainly in the community. And it did a lot for PT Money indirectly. After the first one in 2012, I had my best year ever in terms of traffic and overall revenue for the site. So I knew I had, you know, struck gold with having that conference. And then I told myself after that first conference, like, I don't care if I make another dollar on this conference ever. Like, if it does this for PT Money and my brand overall, I'll keep doing it every year for free. And then PT Money kind of took a dive traffic wise. I need to figure out how to make money off the conference again, but, that's a different story. But yeah. It's cool because, you know, I started that conference to really get together with folks and meet my heroes. I mean, JD and Jim and those guys, man, they were my heroes. You know, I grew up reading those guys. Well, not grew up, but I'd been reading those guys before I started my blog. They were my motivation. So getting to meet them and have that conference for them and engage with them and make them partners with me in that. Was a dream come true, really. I mean, it was kind of the culmination of all I'd done so far. And, man, it was a really blessing to kind of hit on that at the right time. So it's been fun and rewarding. I mean, in many ways, different ways, like I said.
Love it. Well, his PT site is ptmoney.com. FinCon 14 is September 18th to the 20th, 2014 in New Orleans. Or
Nolens.
If you're from there, where can we go to learn more about FinCon 14, PT?
Yeah, I got a new URL. It's at finconexpo.com. So check that out. I'm also on Twitter with FinCon at FinCon. And that's FinCon for anyone who doesn't get the acronym there. yeah, so check us out. It's a good time. We have a lot of we're a money conference. We talk a lot about money, but we talk probably more about online business and entrepreneurship and sort of this new media entrepreneurship sphere. And so we have a lot of podcasters there. It's a good time, you know, and I think a lot of people from different niches can come and learn a lot about just how to run their business better.
Nice. Well, I'm looking at the register page and the early bird prices end June 30th. So you have to jump on that quickly. Last side question. You use Eventbrite for that. Do you recommend that? Are they a good resource to use?
I really love Eventbrite. I mean, they're kind of costly on the fee side, but a lot of they do more than just help you sell tickets. I mean, they help you gather data, with all your messaging, interactivity with your website. I mean, so many things that the affiliate program, I mean, so many extra things now that they offer other than just helping you sell the ticket, that to me, it's worth it to kind of eat that fee. So,
well, there you go. All right. Jump on that. FinConExpo.com, PTMoney.com. PT, thanks so much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love it if you join us every Monday morning to hear the latest episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown podcast. Remember, the place to go to find the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more is www.entrepreneurshowdown.com. And while you're there, leave us your email address to find out about upcoming guests, latest episode releases, and a whole lot more.